Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, VR benchmarks, the world's thinnest laptop. It's from HP and has an amazing hinge, NVIDIA's Pascal, iPhone SE performance, and so much more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 358, recorded April 7th, 2016. That is so thin. And can we benchmark VR, please?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/twitch and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/twitch.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you a giant pile of incredibly useful and informative news and discussion around computer hardware, mobile hardware, VR, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, subwoofers. In fact, this is our very special all subwoofer edition of This Week in Computer Hardware. Yeesh. I kid people. Why you gotta be a hater? I bet I could keep you spellbound with a conversation about subwoofers right now, especially since you're trying to watch a new Star Wars movie without a subwoofer.
Yeah, and it was very apparent. Like, so, you know, normally if you're just like watching regular broadcast television, a subwoofer doesn't really make a big difference, right? Dialogue, you're not going to get a whole lot of bass out of it unless you've got it turned up too high. And I just like, I was watching something on TV and I thought, I'm pretty sure I'm not getting any bass out of the subwoofer. It's only coming out of my satellites and towers. And sure enough, like, put in the Force Awakens Blu-ray this morning and like went to the head unit and turned up the bass all the way and heard no difference. I was like, well, damn it. So the research begins. But it's like I was talking with Ken yesterday. I was like, I've had the speakers I have are right. Old, but speakers don't really age in a way like we're used to talking about on This Week in Computer Hardware, right? And in fact, the number one best-selling subwoofer on Amazon was first released on Amazon in 2006. Right? Which is mind-boggling to me. There's this Polk 10-inch subwoofer powered sub that has 2,600 customer reviews or something like that. And it's been for sale since 2006. So that I find it's so different than the world that I live in pretty much day to day.
There's a whole different set of mountains to climb if you want to upgrade equipment on a regular basis in the audio universe. Yeah. I don't know. It would be fun to have you compare that Polk versus a shoe subwoofer. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
So much news this week. We should get that part of the show rolling. HP announces the world's thinnest laptop, the Spectre 13.3. Sebastian wrote this up for PCPer.com. They're claiming, and man, just stare at that picture for a second. I do not hear the siren song of ever thinner electronics, but that looks like an absolutely utterly impressive piece of engineering. 10.4 millimeters. That's as thin as a AAA battery, not using a Core M processor, not using a mobile system on a chip, a full Intel Core i5 or Core i5 mobile processor, 2.45 pounds, aluminum and carbon fiber, a recessed piston hinge. Hand polished, folds into itself to enable ultra thin 10.4 millimeter profile.
So do you see that I actually think that hinge is really interesting. If you look at the top picture, I don't know how that curves back under the inside. Does it? Because it's got to be one solid piece, right? It's not going to like collapse a little bit or something like that, or kind of unfurl. But it looks really cool. I guess
it is a stunning piece of A, engineering, and B, style design, period. And the fact that it's coming from HP is particularly impressive. I don't really, HP tends to, I love the logo. I love the style. I love the design. I'm very, 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 very curious to feel what the keyboard feels like, because keyboards have been problematic on every, darn near every ultra-thin laptop has been meh as far as the keyboard goes. And I think keyboards are kind of critical when you're talking about, laptops. The Intel hyperbaric cooling system, which has been floating around for, I guess, six, 7 years now. But it's a very interesting concept where they're basically sucking cool air in and shoving hot air out from both sides of the design. It's amazing. Right. When you scroll down below that, you're basically looking at the bulk of the computer. The computery parts of the computer are all pretty much contained right there. And Ryan, if you look at the upper left and upper right, of those fans, I think you're seeing some of what's going on with that hinge design, that piston hinge design.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so it's going down through the depth to the entire depth of the system there. Yeah,
possibly. Okay. I'd be really, it's an interesting looking piece of engineering. HP certainly has the wherewithal to engineer something that will not fall apart. The specs are good. 8 gigabytes of RAM, which doesn't really excite me too much. I would prefer 16 gigabytes, but 256 or 512 gigabyte PCI SSDs. So it'll be a little bit slower than NVMe versions. 3 USB ports, a Type-C port, 2 Thunderbolt, an audio jack, 2.45 pounds, starting at $1,170 for a 256 gigabyte Core i5 system. And again, these are nice processors, Core i5-6200U or the Core i7-6500U. No ship date announced. No Wi-Fi standards released, no information on the memory specs, other than that it will be 8 gigabytes. So if you're a superpower user, this may not be the laptop for you. I want to say Gordon Ma Ung got hands-on with it over at PC World. There's some more close-up pictures of there. Essentially what they did is they made super thin hinges and put pistons on them to apply pressure is what they're saying. It's a really good looking piece of hardware, and I'm really curious to see how it holds up in the real universe. But man, way to go, HP. You get some.
Agreed. Looks good. What do you think about the new logo or the reused logo?
I like it. It's very it's stylish. It's aggressive, I guess, is probably the word I'd use for it. So
yep. Cool.
NVIDIA Pascal architecture details, Tesla P100, GP100, GPU. Is any of this going to show up for end users, or is this pretty much super high-end stuff?
These
are hyperscale data center GPUs, right?
Yeah, it is, right? So this specific configuration will probably not make it to consumers, at least not first, right? This may be something down the line once they maybe have saturated as many as they think they can sell. What's important here is that this is the first time we've seen NVIDIA talk about the Pascal architecture, other than just kind of seeing it as a bullet point on a roadmap, I guess. What they've announced is they announced the Tesla P100, which is it's not a graphics card. It's an add-in card. It's an accelerator card. It doesn't even connect through PCIe. It connects through NVLink, which is their kind of new proprietary chip-to-chip communication protocol, which is super fast. But if you kind of compare it back to what we saw in previous generations, right, where NVIDIA will come out and announce the super high-end Tesla part. The previous one was the M40. That was the Maxwell-based GPU. Then they had the K40. That was the Kepler-based full-size GPU. You get an idea of kind of how the architecture scales from those parts up to here, and you can kind of guess or assume or make some estimates as to what happens when you go from, your current consumer parts to high-end consumer parts based on Pascal. Like, take, for example, the Titan X GPU based on Maxwell has, I think, 2,880 CUDA cores in it, right? So just below the Tesla M40 there, that's also based on Maxwell, but it's a slightly bigger chip. The full version of the GP100 has 3,800, over 3,800. So we're talking 1,000 more CUDA cores on the full Pascal chip as that we had on the full Maxwell chip. That's a significant difference there. And that's FP32 single precision. If you look at double precision, which is more important for high performance computing, notice that that number 4 in the Maxwell column actually goes up to 32 on the other side. That's how many CUDA cores for double precision you're getting in each SM. So instead of really shunting the performance of double precision compute on this one, it's actually way higher than anything we've seen before. Also, if you look at the clock speeds of this Tesla P100 part, the base clock is 1300 megahertz with a boost clock of 1480. Titan X was under 1000 megahertz, I think. And this, you can see the Maxwell part was under 950 and the Kepa part was under 750 for base clock. So that's a significant clock speed increase. And it could go either way on this. Like, you could either say, well, these are going to be the best possible chips that are going to sell in these high-performance computing things, or you could take the mindset that I think they have taken through all the last previous generations, which is they're a little bit more conservative on these high-performance computing parts because they have to worry about, you know, reliability, memory, ECC memory, all this type of stuff that you don't want any kind of hiccups in. And so you might guess then that the clock speeds of the consumer-based Pascal parts might be higher than even that. Right, which would be significant. And these are also using HBM2 memory, so high bandwidth memory 2, generation 2, which is a step above what we saw on AMD's Fiji architecture. Okay. 4096-bit memory bus, 16 gigs of memory on each one of these modules. That's a lot. I think we're talking about 730, 770 gigabytes per second of memory bandwidth on it. That's a significant amount, but it is a 300 watt TDP, so this is going to draw a lot of power. But look at the transistor count on that, 15.3 billion transistors compared to the full size Maxwell chip of 8 billion transistors. So this new 16 nanometer FinFET technology is giving us a lot of potential headroom for things, and it's kind of getting me pretty excited about what the next GPUs will actually be able to offer when they're eventually released on the consumer side, the GeForce brands, the Quadro brands, and then on the AMD side, the Polaris chips. Because these are super expensive. These are not anything, they're not video cards. They don't have display outputs. They don't connect to the PCI bus. This isn't something that, if I'm really rich, I'm going to buy one of these and play games on it. That's you're not going to be able to do that. As of now, I think the only way to buy these is from a server that's built by NVIDIA that has 8 of them in one system. And I believe that entire system is $129,000. I think, yeah. $129,000 gets you 170 teraflops of computing and 8 of those processors. So if you kind of do the math, take out the cost of the Xeons that are in there and everything, you're looking at like $15,000 a chip, which is probably a pretty significant margin for them, which is why they're starting at this place as opposed to maybe the consumer side of things, as you might be willing to guess. But it's impressive technology, and I think sets up, the late summer of this year for an interesting battle between what AMD is going to have and what NVIDIA is going to have in terms of technology and GPUs, right? It seems likely to me now that AMD is going to have power-efficient small chip GPUs, and NVIDIA might have a little bit more power-hungry but larger chips to go up against it. So how that stacks up and what the product SKUs look like from each vendor will be really interesting.
All right. It'll be exciting to see what people end up doing with those.
Yeah.
Sorry, everyone. The iPhone SE is an apology to big phone haters everywhere. It's a really good write-up. If you've been on the fence about an iPhone SE, Ars Technica has a great write-up where they basically put it toe-to-toe with, other iPhones. Geekbench 3 single core, looking at iPhone SE, 6S, 6, 5S. And the iPhone SE is a huge jump over the iPhone 6 and an even huger jump over the iPhone 5S. They look at the cameras, comparing everything from like the iPhone 4S to the iPhone 6S in basically both bright and low light or lower light settings. They take a look at the Wi-Fi browsing test running at 200 nits. 700 minutes for the iPhone SE versus 651 for the iPhone 6S Plus, which I am surprised. And the iPhone 6 Plus got 702 minutes. And I was kind of, I was trying to figure out how could the battery life be so much better for the SE or comparable for the iPhone 6 Plus versus the SE, when I suddenly realized that the SE has a lot smaller case to stuff battery into. So despite the fact that it's probably consuming a lot less electricity compared to that big old screen on the 6 or 6S Plus. They seem to be pretty enthusiastic about it. You know, they're a little frustrated about it topping out at 64 gigabytes. They'd like to see better display quality. You know, no Touch ID sensor, no 3D Touch. And, you know, as we said when we were talking about it a few weeks ago, do not get the 16 gigabyte version. It is tempting. Don't. I think you'll be immensely frustrated with that as soon as you start taking a lot of pictures. But if you've been looking for benchmarks, the benchmarks are that it's really good, and basically an iPhone, you know, a top of the line iPhone stuffed into a smaller enclosure. Another crazy article is linked up on PC Per. The Register: memory and storage boundary changes. Two transitions starting that will radically speed up storage. Chris Miller wrote this up for the Register, and it's kind of crazy when you're looking at this, sort of the faster and costlier versus slower and cheaper. And at the far right end, you have tape and cloud, and then you work through SAN, hard disk drive, basically local SSDs or hard drives, SSDs, NVMe, PCIe, NVMe flash, all the way over to the processor and cache, basically the memory on your system. It's a really good article to take a look at and start looking in terms of access latencies. You know, L1 cache reference, 0.5 nanoseconds. L2 cache reference, 7 nanoseconds. DRAM access, 200 nanoseconds. You know, SAN array access, 300 million nanoseconds. you know, looking at the memory and storage boundary, it's really, if you want to start getting to the sort of deeper concepts of what's going on with how, you know, the claims of what XPoint's going to do and how it's going to change storage and how we access data and information, it's a really interesting article. Did Alan talk about this at all, or?
No, we didn't touch on it.
And the idea is that XPoint is going to blur the line, I'm quoting Jeremy here, between local storage and memory cache storage, offering latency previously only seen in system memory or on die cache. It's curious. I got enthusiastic about it.
It's interesting. It looks it's interesting to see like the data kind of presented like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing, you know, the
300 million nanoseconds.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny, right? You know, we talk about like, there's the water in you, the water in the glass on the table, the water that you walk down the hallway to get from the faucet. Then there's the water you get if you walk all the way down to the bay. And these are, you know, L1 cache, L2 cache, memory, you know, the hard drive, the network. But it's interesting to look at sort of an analysis of what's going on there. So... if you are looking for a entry level or kind of the best low cost 1080p card right now, the GTX 950 is the way to go. And of course, literally in a true Laportian moment, within 24 or 48 hours of me having bought, oh look, here it is right here, an EVGA GTX 950 for a system build. EVGA released the GeForce GTX 950S. Or announced, I can't find it for sale anywhere. Basically, low power versions of the GTX 950, which do not require PCI Express power connections to work. So I was like, really? Yeah. Really?
Well, I mean, there should not be a high variance in performance, right? The clock speeds are a little bit different on the overclocked SKUs. Sure. If you look at the table there, like the ones that that have 6-pin power run a little bit faster than those that don't have 6-pin power. But not anything to really worry about, I guess.
It was just more having one less cable inside my little tiny
That's true. Especially
closure.
If you're doing the mini ITX stuff, cable routing is one of the big pains in the butts that you got to deal with anyway, so.
Just saying. There's one less cable to route. Too much to ask to have one less cable to route. Apparently, I should have asked the day before. Just a heads up. I thought it was interesting. Advanced topics. Maury wrote this up at PCPro.com. Thermaltake Core X9 EATX Cube Chassis Advanced Topics. This is like a second article on an enclosure.
Yeah.
I thought this was kind of awesome and kind of frightening. And I mean that with love and respect when I say it. It was like, wow, there's so much to say about this case. It required an entire second article.
Well, it's so big, right? And so here's the secret for this. Maury bought this case and he's like doing one of his like modded builds to take the QuakeCon in it. So he was spending an inordinate amount of time inside this chassis. So it made sense for him to kind of like basically build log it as he was taking it apart and dissecting it to figure out what parts, what it could fit, what it could even do. That was the first story. The second one is him like actually, okay, now I'm going to install hardware in it, right? And if you've never seen this chassis, it's enormous, right? The pictures, it's hard to see what it is in scale. If you start to look through, you know, second, third, fourth page of this, when he's installing, you know, triple thick 360-millimeter radiators and it takes up a fraction of the space of the bottom of this case, you start to go, oh, yeah, no, I get it now. Because he's got bottom-mounted radiators, front-mounted radiators, reservoirs all over the place. And it takes all of this hardware and it's in this case is like, yeah, cool. Now give me more of that stuff. I got more room. You got to fill this up. and if you go to like second last page where he looks at the sample system build, you can see what it is once it's put together. And even looking at it like with the window on the side and you can kind of see like some of the stuff going on in there. It's you got to keep in mind that the ATX motherboard is not. It's rotated, how do I say this, so that the front connectors are at the back. And if you scroll down a couple of pictures, you'll see, like, the cases or the motherboard is, like, in the middle of the case, and you have all this other space around it. So it's like you took an ATX chassis, rotated it 90 degrees, and then put another ATX chassis on top of it and below it. And that's about how much space you have inside this case. It's actually, yeah, it's like a cube of ATX cases stacked on top of each other, essentially.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you see all the stuff that he's got in here, and it's like, it's not even close to being crammed. Like, you would think you put that much stuff in a system, it's going to be like you building your mini ITX chassis, sure. Right? No, not at all. You got more fittings, you got more right angle brackets you got to go through, no problem. We can do that. So, it's an interesting project. I think he's got one more article planned for this where he actually builds out and customizes all the stuff specifically for what he's doing. But this is, I mean, there's a ton of pictures in here. It's worth looking at. If you're a hardware nerd, you're going to like at least exploring what all this is. So
cool. Build all the things inside a case. It's good stuff. Just wanted to share that. Oh my goodness. Hey, we should take a moment to thank nice people over at Wealthfront. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Wealthfront. You invest for the long term for you or your family's financial health, right? But trying to do it yourself, especially the right way, is complex and time-consuming, which is why we're happy to say there is Wealthfront. Traditional advisors, they charge fees, pretty huge fees, between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, no hidden fees. We're talking about less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. They're not going to bog you down with dozens of questions. They've simplified their risk identification process that allows you to begin investing sooner. It takes a few minutes to sign up at Wealthfront.com. Goes right to work. Monitors your portfolios around the clock, takes action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront portfolios, they're based on modern portfolio theory, right? So they adjust according to your personal risk tolerance while staying diversified and tax efficient. You know, the idea is that, you know, you're close to retirement, you're more risk averse, you're younger, you want to be going optimizing for more growth, which means more risk. It's going to take care of that for you. It's transparent. It's accessible. You can view and track all your accounts at one place. And now Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts that they'll provide in a summary of all your assets. So you have a dashboard, with all your financial data. You can see every trade Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard on your desktop or on their mobile app. They're managing over $2.6 billion in client assets. It's growing rapidly every day. Want to retire someday, right? You want to get a hold of your financial? Yeah. Do you want to know what's going on with your finances? It's time for you to invest in your future today. And we'd like you to check out Wealthfront. Visit Wealthfront.com/Twitch to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 free of charge for life. Do yourself a favor. Join the many Twit fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront. Wealthfront.com/Twitch, T-W-I-C-H. If you want to support the show, Wealthfront.com/Twitch. Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 free of charge for life. Do yourself a favor. Wealthfront.com/Twitch and start yourself on the path to financial growth and adventure. Get yourself going there, people. We want to thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Indeed.
Brace for impact, people. Now that he's revolutionized the way GPUs are tested, Ryan Shrout has his grubby little paws on the future of VR testing. Wait. He's laying the groundwork for the future of VR testing.
That's closer. Yeah. Yeah.
You want objective metrics for measuring VR performance.
Yes. And not only do I want them, I think they're actually, excuse me, more important than ever to have, right? As I say, like in the first couple of paragraphs of that story, when you're gaming on a standard system, right, on a 2D screen, a flat screen, if you get a judder or you get a tear, you see it and you move on, right? If you get judder or low frame rates or weird kind of patterns in VR, you get uncomfortable, you get nauseous, you get sick, you get headaches. You can't physically endure what it's doing to you, right? So there are much more serious implications about poor performance and bad game profiling in virtual reality than there was on standard gaming or console gaming or anything like that, right? The problem is that none of the tools that we have today that work on current PC gaming, like standard PC gaming, really translate over to VR. It's a complicated story of why, but like one reason, like the thing we did recently is develop a capture based performance metric, right? Where we're actually capturing the output that's going to the monitor, and then we post process analyze it, and we can give you very accurate, very detailed looks at what the animation and smoothness is like. We can't capture the output going to the headset yet. I think we should be able to, but we haven't been able to solve that problem. The other problem is from the software side. If you look on the PC that's being tested, we're used to being able to run software like Fraps or an overlay that is able to kind of intercept the game at a particular point and inject itself so that we can get polling data out of it, right? How many frames are you making per second? What iteration are those at? With the VR SDKs from both Oculus and Steam VR or OpenVR, that shifts. Now the game doesn't submit a frame to DirectX, it submits frames to the SDK, the VR API essentially. And then the VR API is responsible for sending the data to DirectX, getting responses, and then sending the data out to the screen. It doesn't show up as a normal monitor, your head-mounted display. And inside that VR API, it's doing things to the final render to help improve smoothness and help improve user experience, but we don't get the ability to watch them. We don't have timers. We don't have counters. We don't know what's happening inside that pipeline. It's kind of like a black box to us right now. So the jump is on to find data like this, as you're seeing on the screen, in some form that makes sense. So this is actually part of frame timing data that is revealed through SteamVR. And as you can tell, there is a ton of data that needs explained, needs understood, and we're trying to get a hold of the right people who develop these tools to actually teach us about what's going on. The one that stood out to me there is at the very top, there's a teal line that is labeled total GPU. And as far as I can tell, that's total GPU render time, how long the GPU actually has worked. So what we did was, over the last week or so, is essentially we combined a couple of tools, one pre-existing that gave us a look at information that was being displayed on the monitor, not the head-mounted display, and that total GPU metric from inside SteamVR. And we were able to correlate total GPU render time to experience in a headset, right? Which is kind of, that's the total goal, right? You want to be able to correlate a number you get on a graph to what the experience is actually like. And I think we were able to do that. And I think we're able to kind of make assertions about GPU hardware, like, hey, GTX 970 in this game that we use for testing called The Gallery, on the low preset is able to go between what we had as a high GPU render scene that we could look down at and a low GPU render scene that we could look up at. And it could, as long as it keeps the render time under 10 milliseconds or so, mm-hmm. then it's able to maintain a 90 frames per second output to the total system, right? That's 11.1 milliseconds for those of you interested in keeping track at home. But if you turn up to high, that next graph, you'll see that there's some variance in the blue line. The blue line is that render time. And as soon as that render time gets above 10 milliseconds, you'll notice that the orange line that represents the present time, the frame rate that we're seeing on the head-mounted display, is actually jumping up quite a bit. The frame time is jumping up, so the frame rate is jumping down, I guess I should say. So that goes up to 22.2 milliseconds, which is essentially 45 frames per second. And as we, you know, the blue line comes back down as we change the scene that we're looking at, you can see the render time goes down, and then it goes back up as we look back at the more GPU-intense section. So we're able to correlate our GPU render time to an experience in the head-mounted display. And then, you know, we can again correlate that if you go down to the next graph, it looks at a higher-end GPU on the exact same setup, and we still have that variance in the blue line, but the orange section stays centered on 22.2 milliseconds because we never approach that 10-millisecond kind of cutting-off point where the engine and the VR API and SDK has to go, oh, well, we didn't get enough frames done in time. We have to fall back to our next V-Sync interval. Because remember that the headsets are not going to – they're forced V-Sync on. They're not going to tear. So if you're not running at 90, you're basically running at 45, right? Whether that be for a split second for an extended period of time, those are your options, right? And so there's a lot of other data in there where we kind of go, okay, if we take that and now we compare 970 to 980 directly, or we compare AMD to NVIDIA in a couple of instances, you can start to get an idea of how we can use this data to measure performance. Now, the problem is this is one game, one situation, one scenario. Every game is going to be different in VR because they all treat that kind of the viewport to your monitor very differently. We found some interesting effects where how do I explain this easily? So that video is called Pull In. When it's actually shifting the image, you can see like the black on the right hand side of the VR display kind of go in and out of the screen. Some the other video shows that you can actually experience two different animation speeds at the same time on a headset because the ability for the VR SDK API to warp an image applies to your head rotation, but it doesn't apply to the things animating on the screen. So as a result, you can have, like in that video, the hand animates at 45 frames per second, but the panning animates at 90 frames per second effectively. And that's kind of an interesting phenomenon to kind of experience. And I don't need to get into more detail than that here, but if you go read the article at PCPro.com, it will get into why that is, you know, what a good analogy for somebody is to do sure. with their own monitor at home and that type of stuff. Alan came up with the comparison to imagine if you had a 50-inch monitor on your desk that takes up the same field of view as your head-mounted display. If you're running a game at 45 frames per second, everything you see on that screen is going to run at 45 frames per second. But if you actually move your own head side to side, mm-hmm. right, that animation is smooth, right, because your mind and your eyes are not limited to that frame rate. And so that's how you can kind of experience two frame rates at the same time. But
That's a big concept to wrap your head around.
It really is. And I'm probably not doing it justice in a short form like this. But it's definitely worth going to check out. And if nothing else, it's starting the pathway. But the more we learn, the more complicated it gets, actually, instead of the opposite, which is what I was hoping. The more we learn, the more we would find like the solution to go down. Right. Because every game has the ability to treat all these different aspects slightly different. So you kind of have to validate each testing methodology with each game and then hope that they don't change those things down the road. Whereas with standard PC testing, we had kind of figured out a standardized way to do things. But that's okay, because that was broken by DirectX 12 and Universal Windows platforms as well. So basically, we don't know how to test anything anymore. And so that whole retirement ad that we did in the previous block became much more important to me.
While we're talking about the future of VR, Oculus Rift, Jeremy's got a good summary of what's going on, but the EULA for the Oculus Rift TNCs are brutal. You know, the register went through it. It's basically Facebook can track your usage while you're using the headsets. They will use the data collected for targeted advertising. Doesn't seem to be any blackout mode or incognito mode. Slashdot has a pretty good post that discusses basically that if you create something, Oculus won't claim to own it if you use the Oculus to create it, but they say they can use it without your consent and without having to pay you for using this. Quote, to those of a weak disposition to look away, news has reached us that Face Fun virtual reality machine and eye of Facebook, the Oculus Rift, has features that track things that people do and use the information for the purposes of advertising. What a shock.
Yeah.
But it's the terms of service are pretty pretty impressive. That's what I'll say. Slimy, impressive.
They kind of came out and had a statement, I think, after this post went up. They're like, oh, no, we promise we're not doing any of that. But they wouldn't like commit to not doing that into in perpetuity. Right. So there's that. The advertising targeting thing is one thing. The other stuff about like concern for content creators, where anytime you create something, they can apparently own it and they can use it without your consent. They won't claim they own it, but they can use it without your consent. And they don't have to pay you anything to use it. So if you create a really cool piece of art in something, they can just say, yeah, no, we're going to use that in all of our ads and all of our promotions going forward, and you don't really get to do anything about it.
To some degree, you could say they have the ability to do that already with almost anything you post on Facebook, it feels like sometimes.
True. But
yeah, it's funny. If you go to the Oculus.com legal/privacy policy page, right, what kind of information is collected? It's one, information you give us. Two, information automatically collected about you when you use our services. Information about your interaction with our services, games, content, apps, or experiences with collected in or through cookies, local storage, pixels, and similar technologies. Information about how you access our services, including information about the type of device you're using, headset, PC, or mobile device, your browser operating system, your IP address, certain device identifiers that may be unique to your device, information about the games, content, or other apps installed in your device, location information, which can be derived from information such as your IP address, information about your physical movements and dimensions when you use a virtual reality headset. We may receive information about you from other companies that are within the family of related companies that are legally part of the same group of companies that Oculus is a part of. Let me read that sentence again one more time. We may receive information about you from other companies that are within the family of related companies that are legally part of the same group of companies that Oculus is part of or become part of that group, such as Facebook, and they combine that information with other information we collect about you, view a complete list of related companies at, and then, of course, other sources, including partners that provide us information that is publicly or commercially available, and they combine that information with the other information we collect on you. We use that to provide our services, to communicate with you, to provide technical support, to customize your experiences, to improve or develop your experiences, to market to you, and to promote safety and security. So some of this information is public. Some of this is interesting. You know, every so often I think I need to get a legal degree just so I can figure out whether or not I should feel worried about having to say having to say yes to the EULA on everything.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
On a more cheerful note, did Alan actually gut the poor little Vive?
Yeah.
He gutted the, excuse me, he dissected and explored the Lighthouse tracking system.
There we go.
For the state-of-the-art CC Vive.
It's interesting, right? Yeah, he took it apart. The first page kind of gives you a history of infrared being used in gaming systems. A little bit of story of how the Oculus uses IR. Because it's interesting, if you look at it, the way the Oculus Rift tracks you and the way the HTC Vive track you are very different. The Oculus has a camera that is looking at IR lights that are embedded in the headset. It's hard to tell in that picture, but if you look really closely, there's IR lights in the headset. There's IR lights on the back of the headset as well. And it uses that, uses an integrated, you know, motion tracker, IMU, in the headset. In addition to these IR lights, the camera reads that data. Camera feed goes into the PC. PC is kind of reading that in real time, tracking the dots and adjust your location accordingly. The Vive uses a very different system. You know, it has two lighthouse beacons, right, that go in opposite corners of your room. And those are actually shooting out infrared lasers throughout your room, right? And so your controllers in your headset don't have the infrared. The infrared is actually in the sensors on the side. So what exists in your controller and in your headset is actually infrared reading sensors. So behind each of those divots, you know, the thin layer of plastic is the ability to read infrared. And so it's kind of a very different system on how it works. And then Alan dissected these lighthouses because he was interested in how they worked. And they're 3,600 RPM motors that are rotating, that sweep these laser diodes across the room and XY patterns in sync with each other, right? So that there's not more than one laser sweep going on at a time, because that would obviously confuse everything. So it's interesting to see how this technology works, how they differ, right? The HTC Vive, in theory, should give you better accuracy over a larger space because the lasers and trigonometry don't lose accuracy. Whereas if you have two cameras that were trying to look at IR LEDs in a headset, the further you went away, the less accurate their location data would be, right? The less accurate their positional data could be. So it's very cool. Alan did some research on how it was developed, you know, looking up the guy who did it and getting some information from previous stuff he had posted as well. You know, the motors that they're using are essentially, you know, they're hard drive style motors in the lighthouses, which are interesting. And then you can see a breakdown. That's the inside of one of the controllers. And each one of those little green PCBs and sensors is reading LED, IR LED lasers that hit it. It basically calculates, it knows exactly when the laser was shot out from the beacon. And so it knows how long it took, and thus it can calculate how far away it is. And thus that's how it starts to get all the tracking information that it sends back to your system and then back to your VR game and then back into the GPU that gets rendered out to your head-mounted display. When you start to think about all the stuff that happens for you to get a real-time, very accurate, low-latency tracking system for any of this stuff, it's amazing it all works at all, right? Yeah. It's amazing that it functions.
It's incredibly complicated and it's incredibly sophisticated, and you start to realize how much data is being handled in real time. It should seem kind of amazing and complicated, right? It's an actual palpable virtual reality. But then you start to realize, like, wow, a lot of work inside. Oh, now I understand why Oculus has a game controller.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting because it's a totally inverse way of doing it between the two systems, the Rift and the Vive. And I'm very curious once Oculus comes out with their touch controllers and they have to release, you know, whatever either cameras or sensors are going to have to do the same thing. If they're going to adopt something that's similar to this, or if they're going to use, like, well, we've just got two cameras in the room, maybe three cameras in the room, two new ones that come with the touch controllers and your original one, and we're going to use that positional tracking data in our own way. So next time I do an Oculus demo with touch controllers, I'm going to see, like, are they using cameras or are they using IR in a different way? But, I mean, if it's going to track the headset, Maybe the controllers in the headset get tracked differently. It's possible that would be a way they could do it. But pretty interesting stuff nonetheless. So if you're just kind of a technology geek, I think you'll like what Alan was able to dissect, as you said, from the hardware. Yeah.
It's a pretty awesome. It's a pretty awesome read. Michael Allen. Microsoft Surface phones. The Inquirer's got a pretty good write-up. Three models tipped for 2017 launch. Should you not have had enough of the suffering of the Windows Phone user? Wow, that was really cruel even for me. So essentially what we're talking about is the Surface phone or the little Surface. Windows Central says that, quote, I'm quoting the Inquirer here, despite earlier speculation about an imminent arrival, Microsoft Surface phone won't see an official launch until 2017. You know, the report says that Microsoft is dialing back on Windows 10 mobile or Windows phone development because Windows 10 mobile, they're trying to make it better. And quote, to come back with a strong product to disrupt the market, unquote, which is a way of saying, you know, we don't want to launch a whole bunch of hardware while we're sitting at, you know, a total market penetration that is roughly a rounding error for iOS or Android, certainly Android, possibly iOS. Three versions, consumer, business, enthusiast versions of the phone are rumored. I will be curious to see when they ship and, you know, if they are going to, you know, because basically the rumors are 5.5-inch QHD AMOLED screen, Intel Atom CPU, 4 gigabytes of RAM, which would be epic, and 64 or 128 gigabytes of storage, which sounds epic now, but a year from now may not be so epic, although I think it'll still be 128 will still be fairly epic storage capacity for a phone even in 2017. But yeah, it's a, you know, early 2017 CES time. We will find out. I'm curious because at this point, you know, I don't think they want to deal, and that's one of the things that the Windows Central article kind of looks at. That their phrase for it: if Microsoft appears to be vacating the low end for a general consumer device, which is a way of saying we can't compete with Android in the no money part of the market. So maybe we should take a little lesson from our friends over at Apple and do something a little more high end with a little more of a market. You know, the other thing is, I think there's just, man, they need something that's going to make this more successful than it has been.
Yeah, to say the least.
AMD pre-announces seventh generation A series system on a chip. Is this anything we should be excited about? Speaking of cruel ways of introducing stories,
I don't know yet. So this is like, it's a pretty early announcement. They haven't gotten into a whole bunch of detail. They even call it, they themselves call it a pre-announcement, which I don't even. That's like before we were talking about the trailer for the Star Wars movie. This is a pre-announcement for an announcement with just a little bit of detail. It's for their upcoming seventh generation APU, codenamed Bristol Ridge. It's based off the Excavator architecture that was used in Carrizo, but Carrizo is more of a low-end, like low-power part. And so this is the first time that architecture is coming up to the higher priced, higher performance SKUs. Josh wrote this up. They didn't have a whole bunch of details in here about what the differences are, but they have a couple of hints. They do have a die shot. Interesting differences, apparently, with that is that there aren't any significant differences there. But there are extra units around the border we don't really understand yet. It's still kind of waiting to see what they do there. This is still being built on 28 nanometer technology from Global Foundries, so you won't have any kind of dramatic process tech changes that kind of make this a runaway success. But they've improved power gating, clocking technologies, so you should be able to see TDPs be lower for better performing parts. Always a step in the right direction. But this is still very much going to be the answer is going to be, what are they going to compete against on Intel's side? When are they going to compete against it? And what's their pricing going to be like, right? So they have to maintain a performance per dollar competitiveness, which makes it difficult for them because they basically have to take you know, essentially higher researched parts and price them lower than they would want to in order to remain competitive, right? So we'll see these in notebooks. We'll see these in maybe some thin and light machines, but like thin client machines as well. It's going to be coming in the AM4 socket infrastructure, probably released at the Computex timeframe. So that's June. I think Computex starts May 30th this year. I'll probably be heading over there for the first time in a handful of years, unfortunately. But that's the way it goes. 15-watt TDPs, at least for the ones we're talking about on the mobile side as well. So, but interesting to note, this will be the first AM4 part, I think, that will be the house that Zen processors will eventually fit in. So in theory, if you have an AM4 motherboard that would be released with this launcher, you have a, if you're an OEM and you have an AM4 infrastructure or kind of build out, that you may be able to support Zen with very little to no work later, end of 2016. So
there you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
PCPro.com is a place to find Ryan Shrout, Alan Malventano, Jeremy, and the whole rest of the crew doing their thing in the hardware universe. If you are interested in benchmarks, hands-on testing, especially in the GPU, SSD, CPU, and ladies and gentlemen, coming to a face near you, VR world, it is the place to go. I'm at techthing.com, making technology behave. A little something useful in every show. Man, this week's show was a blur.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like the amount of stuff we've been doing, we've basically been like, we got to troubleshoot this VR thing. We're you know, we did the benchmarking side of things. Now it's like, how can we apply that to other stuff? I've got like 9 projects all kind of ongoing. I'm trying to buy a church. I don't. There's so many things going on, Patrick, and I don't know if any of them are related to.
Let me pause this for a second, right? Because one thing I have to say is we do teach you, we taught everybody how to magnetize screwdrivers and other tools in this, yep, this week's episode of Tech Thing.
There you go.
And Shannon reviews the Amazon's Tap and the Dot to see if either of them are worthy of her obsession with the Amazon Echo. BitTorrent Sync 2.3 has some fantastic new features, including being integrated as a service inside of Windows. They finally have native Linux supports. But I do want to ask everybody, I'm curious what everybody's using in terms of their system, like what their current CPU, how much memory do you have, what's your GPU? Because I was on a thread with a bunch of very hardcore, you know, computer science-y kind of developers, and most of them, not most of them, but a significant percentage of them were using 4, 5, 6-year-old machines. And I'm kind of curious what everybody's using and what you would like out of a $500 PC for a build I'm working on. So if you got a minute to send your information about what is in your PC and if you're thinking about upgrading it, to ask@techthing.com, I would be eternally grateful. But it's kind of interesting to look what people are using and what kind of performance jumps they expect before they upgrade. So I was really curious about that. But the shoe subwoofers are back on the page, which brings us pretty much back to where we began.
So full circle.
Trying to figure out what sentence was inside of me, and thank each and every one of you for listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find more Twitch at twit.tv/Twitch, at Ryan Shrout and at Patrick Norton are great places to ask questions. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.